And now, an ad from Dad.
All right. Save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive.
Can I take these off?
All right. What is this? This looks good.
Wow. That's well made.
Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rastan, today we have returning curator, preserver of the arts from the East Coast, producer of sorts, Edin Koo.
Good to be back.
And soon to be co-author of a set of memoirs for your father's books.
That's right, launching April 12th.
The name of which is?
IKKK.
Ooh, okay. That's for Malaysia only, by the way. I don't think it'll be selling in America. And the other voice you hear is a theatre producer, director, and writer as well, educator, Jo Kukuthas.
Hello. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. Our three topics this week will be: topic number one is the British Empire. Topic number two is why we should read the Mahabharata. Topic number three is Derek Walcott, the late Jamaican author. West Indian.
St. Lucia,
okay. So with topic number one, came to mind because, well, actually something I think about quite a lot and I write about is the British Empire and the legacy of. Because recently there's an Indian politician, diplomat, very clever man, handsome fleur as well, Shashi Tharoor.
Author.
Did I say that?
No.
Oh, he's done everything. Anyway, and he's come up with a book, Inglorious Empire, and he's going around selling it, and I see his face popping up on my feed where he has been listing and attacking the memory of the British Empire, and especially British people thinking about the British Empire and saying that it was a dreadful thing, caused the death of millions, and took billions of monies away from India and destroyed India. Mm-hmm. And he is a very erudite man, speaks very well, with a voice not entirely dissimilar to my own, but with an Indian accent. And I was wondering, when I was watching him, you know, what should one's reaction be to empire? Malaysia, all of Malaysia was once under, in some way or another, the British Empire. It's not necessarily a thing that people talk about or think about directly all the time, but I do believe the legacy is profound.
Mm. Well, I think you should start by saying that he didn't decide, I'm going to go out and attack the British Empire.
Shashi Tharoor.
No, because I think he was a diplomat, turned MP, and he wrote this actually in response to discovering that people did not know very much about colonial history. So he thought, well, you can't teach history in school if you don't teach also what happened in...
Just about British people, by the way.
Sorry?
British people or people?
What do you mean?
You said people don't know much about...
We found that British people and people people in other parts of the empire, maybe Indian people for that matter as well, did not know very much about their own, inverted commas, colonial history. So his question is, well, why aren't people being taught this as part of history when people are being taught history? So to redress this balance, he said, well, I will tell you a little bit about what I know about this history, which has been left out of many history textbooks.
And he talked, for instance, about the, amongst many things, the Bengal... Famine of 1943-44.
Talks a lot about Amritsar.
Yeah.
Amritsar.
Talks about the number of Indians who were involved in the First World War and the Second World War.
Right.
And of course, he talks a lot about what India was like.
And about the railways.
Colonialism.
Mm. Which is the biggest part of it, actually.
Yes.
And his previous books were never about colonialism or the effect of colonialism, but it was about Indian politics. And in fact, Mahabharata features very strongly and very deeply in his first novel, The Great Indian Novel.
Right. But watching his interviews and also the Oxford Union speech that he gave a few years back, and many other people who talk about the subject of the British Empire, I find always it breaks down into a good thing, bad thing. The argument in reading history is, was it a good thing or a bad thing? It's deterministic. And I think that's missing the point myself, that it is important to know about empire, but to look at the legacies of, and to question whether or not in Malaysia, a colony, if that's the right word, as opposed to the metropole, London, is Malaysian governance and police, for that matter, laws, are we living in essentially a colonial inheritance, or is this a true democracy?
Well, there's also been some debate recently. There was the debate on RU355 recently held at, I think it might have been organized by the Bar Council, I'm not sure. But one of the young lawyers there, very articulate Malay lawyer, who was arguing for RU355, right, brought up this point, very much so, that basically we live under colonial laws, and it's about time we review those colonial laws. So I think one of the very important or incidental things about empire is the colonial factor, that people still somehow feel that they are colonized, right, and so seek to, you know, review all the structures under which they live. I think that's become, you know, increasingly more intense as the project that is the nation state is starting to fail just about everywhere, and people are looking for alternatives. But when you look for alternatives, then you also need something to blame or something to redeem from. And I think colonialism provides a very easy tool.
Very easy tool.
But I think that doesn't discount the fact that very little is known about what is called colonial history, meaning that the history which doesn't make it into mainstream books published in the West. And I think that's still a very important thing to know. It's not about a blame game, but it's about a knowledge game. And if you don't have equal knowledge in all aspects of empire, then surely you can't really look at empire. You can't even really look at present-day post-empire nations.
But you're talking from a British perspective, though. Or are you talking from
even from a local perspective?
No, I think from a local perspective.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, for example, I went to school in India, and of course it was a British school in India, but of course my teachers and my classmates were mixed. Some were from the Empire, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK, and some were from India. But I remember the time when we studied the Indian Mutiny, so-called, the Indian Mutiny of 1857. And of course, all the books that we had that were British books all, you know, looked at it as being the Indians done wrong, and the sepoys mutinied and did terrible things, and we read novels that sort of, also told the same story. But luckily, our history teacher said, well, let's look at what the Indian historians are saying. And so she gave us things that were written by Indian historians. They had a very, very different point of view.
And now in India, I think it's called the First War of Independence.
Yes. And maybe that's also a misnomer, I don't know. But it's important to actually look at these things.
We need to wrap up. But I would just say quickly, though, I think, though, that if we looked at a history of victimhood and if we look at history just as purely good thing, bad thing, we tend to lump everything together. There were many different empires which had their own styles and their own, and left their own legacies. And there were many different British empires. In fact, all the parts that make up Malaysia now were ruled under four different types of British empire.
Right. Yes.
So we have different legacies going on there. Mm. If we stick with a story of victimhood, then we forget agency and we forget Malayans who lived and operated within that system and in good faith and who thought they were doing the right thing. People who came here to find a better life, not because they were complicit or because they were collaborators in an evil empire, but because it made sense to them. And I worry that we lose sight of that if we just make people heroes or villains.
Are we doing that?
I worry that if we look purely at empire as being a list of evil doings, then they must be akin to the Nazis. It must be a horror. They're conquistadors. Well, but if we think about the legacies and the reasons why people chose to
be a part of it. But I don't know if that's what Thoreau is doing in his book. I mean, I haven't read it yet.
The book arrives at a useful time. Now, you said he speaks English with an Indian accent. Actually, he speaks English with a very Oxbridge accent, which one of his nemesis said he picked up while flying over Oxbridge. But nevertheless, I think there's been a lot of colonial nostalgia.
Yeah,
I mean, that's also true.
Yes.
Lots of books about, you know, the British experience in India, which is very nostalgic. My father seems to be going through a hugely nostalgic period about experience about the British. So I think the book is timely.
Yeah. Well, we must move on because we're eating away into the next section, which is Joe's The Mahabharata. An epic, Joe.
Well, my question was about why we should read it, if we should read it, and what's the purpose of reading.
First of all, what is it?
The Mahabharata?
Yeah.
It is an Indian epic, let's say, akin to the Gilgamesh, or akin to Beowulf, or akin to
all the other old epics.
All the other old epics. I'm a loss for the name of the.
Actually, it's the oldest known epic.
Yeah, and the
and
longest.
And the longest, which reigns.
Ten times longer than the Odyssey.
That's right. It's about 332,000 couplets or something like that.
It's very long and it's very epic, I mean, for the want of a better word. And I wanted to come back and look at why this epic in particular, because I think it is quite different from a lot of other epics. But I want to look at the idea of the epic itself and what is an epic, you know, so that you have in most epics a hero on a journey. And it's a figure of a hero who is also part of the national consciousness and maybe also part of a cosmic consciousness, and this hero embodies the cultural ideals of that particular place. So the setting is not just within a country. The setting is larger than a country. It crosses countries. It crosses the cosmos, often goes into the underworld as well, and it revolves around superhuman deeds, you know, and in the playing of these superhuman deeds, you have these actions also being watched by the gods, being watched by supernatural beings who take an interest in it and also maybe take an active part in it. And often it is quite singular. It's a story of one particular hero. But the thing that strikes me about the Mahabharata, which I think is very interesting, is that there is no one singular hero. There are many who are heroes, and then you read another story within the story, and in that story, they are not the hero at all. And I think it's a very interesting, to me, a fascinating way of looking at the world as a world view, that people are heroes within their own stories, but in somebody else's stories, they are quite villainous. So the character of Krishna, for example, who many of us kind of regard as somebody who is wise, all-knowing and benign, and is also painted in this epic as somebody who is cunning and conniving and quite sly.
Can I ask, when you say heroes, does that imply a good guy?
Yes, well, the idea of good versus evil. So right. The hero may embody some ideals which are regarded as important for that time. But it's never that simple. I mean, in the case of the Odyssey, when, what's his name? Ulysses is traveling. Of course,
Odysseus.
Yeah, Odysseus is traveling. Of course, we know that he is very flawed. He's got a lot of faults, and he has many encounters along the way where he gains or loses knowledge. But we are following a single character for the most part.
Right. But he's Achilles in the Iliad.
Right.
From the way we would read him now, he would just come across as a murderous man. He's just fearsome. But in his day, that same story would have been read and it's like, what a hero, what an amazing guy.
Well,
he's the best.
Not really, actually. He's much more complex than that, I think. Even in the old days, he would have regarded... I think, in fact, in the old days, we would have seen greater complexities than we do now. Now we reduce such heroes.
That's what epics are about, essentially, encapsulating these complexities. And I think we've kind of driven this moral wedge into our readings. I think the idea of a hero and anti-hero, you know, when these things were written, when they were experienced, and many of them were experienced, they were not read.
Yeah.
They were actually experienced in performance as parts of ritual and so on. I think the lines were very much more blurred.
And because they weren't linear either necessarily, were they?
Sorry?
And they weren't necessarily told in a linear way either.
No.
So the idea of things having a natural outcome was not important. It's rather a series of events, and people could jump into the middle of the story and take it from there.
I think what an epic addressed a great deal was what it meant to be human. And you get this too, even in our traditions. We are not a Mahabharat culture, we are a Ramayanic culture.
Right.
But again, you see the lines blurring between the purported hero, Rama, and the villain, Ravana.
Yeah.
It's very grey.
Can I, at the risk of Edin snapping at me as being a simpleton and an ignoramus, the Ramayana is about what? It's different in that it is what?
Okay, you're a terrible ignoramus. I don't know how you've lived here for all these decades not knowing what the Ramayana is. Ramayana is perhaps the second longest epic, and it's a love story between Rama, who is a god, but you know it's not very clear what his divine status is, and the love story between Rama and Sita, and the great war between these two big characters, Rama and Ravana, for the love of this woman, Sita.
Okay, good. Just checking. And so you, Edin, I mean, in the East Coast, Wayankulit, you have seen, surely, interpretations of these stories. How are these stories? These are very vernacular. They're very working class, as it were. How are they told?
Very vernacular. No, they're not, if by working class you allude...
I mean, they're entertainment. They're entertainment.
No, they're not. They're very, very sophisticated.
Yeah.
They're about ways of life, really, ways of living and ways of negotiating very big things.
But with jokes.
Yes, with lots of jokes. Of course, his life is full of jokes, but they're dealing with things like war, violence, sex, wealth, distribution of wealth,
gender,
poverty,
is
gender.
Very important thing.
And it's all because they know that in order for people to understand these large concepts, you tell it through the form of a story. And so people can think in metaphor, they can think in symbols. And I think that this ability to think in metaphor is something which we are losing these days because we're taking everything very literally and we're seeing simplistic notions of good and bad.
All right, but then hang on a second. Can I ask another question which exposed me as being stupid? Is Star Wars an epic in your... No? You're shaking your head. I mean, it's a universe. It's set across a universe, a cosmology. People go into the underworld almost. They're heroes, they're villains.
Well, it's a different journeys. Experience altogether. I think the level of participation in an epic is very crucial.
Sorry, for the audience.
Yeah, the level of participation for the audience. Right. I mean, I think Star Wars is a visual experience and quite distant. You could be a fanatic about it, but you are fanatic in a different kind of way. I think the degree of separation is very, very clear. Whereas these are performed in, you know, really imbibed. The value systems are imbibed, the characters are imbibed, and very often, you know, even children who are born are kind of compared
to
certain...
I think if people are still performing or watching Star Wars in a thousand years' time, I think you'd say that
no, it is a different visceral experience. Okay. It really is, yes.
Okay. Right. I'm thinking whether or not it, would, for me, would qualify as being an epic.
With a capital E.
Yeah, with a capital E. I mean, I think it pulls and draws on many things which are in epics, you know, and I think maybe I think of epics as being the source material of a lot of these stories, which now we have. The hero's journey, you know, of course, is central to all these big stories that we have now in cinema.
Okay. So the Mahabharata is, what, you can just go out and buy a book and read it?
In English, it's in 10 volumes.
Right.
Yeah.
But you can read people's versions of it. Yeah. You can read R.K. Narayan's
Yeah, and you could read abridged versions. R.K. Narayan's is very good, actually. Yeah.
It's a good introduction to it.
Yeah. So anyway, so part one has exposed me to the scorn of Edin Kü, and I think and I think I'm going to experience that one more time in part two when we return with one of the late great post-colonial authors here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, it's pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Edin Kü, and Joe Kuthas here on A Bit of Culture. And now, topic number two, three, sorry. But first of all, Edin, you have an amazing fact about the Mahabharata on TV.
Yes, the Mahabharata has been animated and made into a TV series which has been running in India for close to 60 years.
Wow.
And it's really, you know, entire villages gather around to view it. And it's just been going on and on and on.
And they're
now they have an Indonesian version.
And they're not close to finishing.
They're not close to finishing anywhere near close to finishing. There will be riots in India. And they decided to bring it to a close.
Okay. So talk number three, though. Edin, Derek Walcott. Who he? I mean, obviously I know who he is.
Derek Walcott won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1992. And he's a poet from the Caribbean islands, from St. Lucia, to be specific, where I think the population is 53,000 people. And they produced two Nobel laureates already, one in economics and Derek Walcott later on. And for every kind of Philistine who has not read him, who he is.
Stop looking at me.
I came to know Derek Walcott actually from his... He's winning the Nobel Prize.
Right.
And reading his Nobel lecture, which starts off really describing a scene of the Ramayana in the Caribbean. So you have, and you know, it's a wonderful, really amazing lecture on the notion of diaspora, on how diaspora shapes itself into forms of poetry, and the notion, the idea that cultures really take the shape of lyricism, and how sometimes we... When we insulate ourselves in our own religions and cultures, we don't see our neighbors and we don't begin to forge a landscape of the imagination based on the great diversity that sometimes then can exist just around us. I mean, he was very instructive, of course, because he's very much a poet that could have come out from our climate.
Yes.
It's the same social fabric, that strange collision of cultures that ends up in a very tiny place, and the what he calls the shards of language that can be found. Of course, one of the great things about him was he had a dual persona, and he was a poet and a very formal poet who had these great leaps into patois and really led the English language into a whole new visionary and refreshing terrain. And then he was a playwright and a marvelous playwright. Dream of Monkey Mountain, I think, is one of the marvelous plays of the 20th century, which is very, very vernacular. It's full of patois. It's full of...
Sorry to interrupt your gushing, but can I just ask Joe, are you familiar with Mr. Walcott?
Yes.
Yeah? Course, yeah? Yeah? Of course. All right, of course.
But well, maybe because I'm in theatre, so I've read his plays and I've read his poetry because I like poetry.
Can I ask a question, though?
You just need to read the newspapers.
So he's from... he's from St. Lucia. And also, what a lot of people don't know, is there's actually a very large Indian community across the Caribbean world. In fact, there are also Chinese as well.
Yes. Very large communities
of Chinese. Well, as Edin said, it's very similar to here, you know, which is why I do wonder why we do not read these epics like the Mahabharata and the Ramayana in Malaysia, because we have such a shared history, and yet we haven't taken these works and changed them or used them in
yes,
in
and of course
of
we have our own epics. Yeah. I mean, the Ramayana has found a very comfortable place here.
Yes.
Although it's not called the Ramayana, it's called the Epic of Ravana, his nemesis, very interestingly.
Yeah.
But it does show, you know, how things can be absorbed.
Mm. Sorry, I don't follow what you're saying here. So there's an alternate... What? How?
Well, it's the same story.
Right. But it's found a home here, you say.
It's found a home here.
It's the Malay version.
The Malay version of Ramayana is a very well-known version. Yeah. Except that over here, it's not called the Epic of Rama. Mm. It's called the Epic of Ravana, his nemesis. Because, of course, the people here identify a great deal with this character, Ravana. But you see what epical imaginations do and what Derek Walcott, of course, possessed living in a climate such as this. And, of course, he wrote Omeros, which was a retelling of the Odyssey. And he wrote it in Patois. A lot of it was in Patois. But, you know, he always fell back on his climate, his culture and environment, giving him the kind of freedom, freedom that is already in the climate and in our surroundings and recreate.
So you would say that a Malaysian audience would be able to appreciate his work and feel it's very...
I think he's quite well known among Malaysians.
No, I don't just mean that. But, I mean, if they read his work, then it would feel like as if it could be of here.
You know, I read him at a very important period in my life when I was, of course, beginning to get involved in traditional culture and traditional performance, ritual performance and so on. And I think he really opened up avenues into which you were able to interpret what it is I was experiencing.
But I think, you know, if it's no different in terms of our experience reading someone like Walcott as reading someone like Naipaul. It's very similar in that way. But very different sensibility from Naipaul. Yes. A much larger person, I think, in many ways,
Can I ask then, Joe, Edin's talking about Walcott as being very important in his way of seeing this part of the world. Do you have a Walcott-type figure?
In Malaysia?
For Malaysia.
Well, I'm hoping Edin Koo will fill...
Not necessarily a Malaysian, but, you know, somebody from a part of the world that wouldn't seem to be appropriate, but actually is. You know, like you said, V.S. Naipaul just now. Is Naipaul your Walcott? Because I know that you do like Naipaul.
Very strange territory beginning.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's not about... It can't really make these comparisons. I mean, there are different writers from different parts of the world whose experiences I enjoy reading about, and I do feel that they speak to my experience as well. And certainly the first time I read Walcott, I felt the same way that the first time I read House of Mr. Biswas, where I felt, here's somebody who can tell me about an experience in a very faraway place, and yet I can completely understand it in terms of my really quite immediate sense of self as well and self-identity.
You know, in fact, I think I lent Joe a book called What the Twilight Says,
which she never returned. But actually, I mean to return it because it's in my shelf, which is to be returned shelf.
It's okay. I love you that much.
So Edin, then, of Walcott's...
I was hoping you wouldn't bring that up.
So of Walcott's body of work, then, what would you ask people to...
I would go out and get a collected poems. I think the poetry is just so luscious and beautiful.
Do you know, for me, I am kind of... I've always been aware of Walcott throughout my life, and yet I have never actually read a single thing that he has written.
You should read some of his essays. I think you'd find them really enjoyable.
Yeah, but Cam's a very empirical evidence person, you know?
He's very empirical
evidence.
No
time for metaphors. No, you and my father would get along very well.
It's not that. I think it's called object displacement. If I don't actually see it in front of me, that doesn't exist. So there you go, folks. That's Derek Walcott. I will. But now we move on to the final part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something we think might be of interest. I am going to go first. And I think we're going to try and recommend something related to our topic. So my recommendation will be empire-related. And so I'd like to recommend a trilogy of books by a man. Well, he was a man then. He became a woman later. And when he was a man, his name was James Morris. And it's the Pax Britannica trilogy. The last one was called Farewell the trumpets. The second one was called, I can't remember actually, but it's a really wonderful, it's now about 25, 30 years old, trilogy of books that just goes around the empire in a very illuminating way, and, you know, full of images and an understanding, really quite deep understanding. Later on, the same author became Jan Morris and has written a lot of very wonderful books on, say, Venice and Wales, and et cetera, et cetera. She remains a very good writer. Mm. So that's the James Morris, at that time, Pax Britannica trilogy. And then Joe goes second.
I think I would just recommend then you go out and find things connected to the Mahabharata in some way. You know, it's a story of a family squabble on a cosmic level, so people can connect to it. You know, brothers fighting brothers, civil war, wholesale destruction. At the end of the Mahabharata, we enter the age of Kali Yuga, which is the age that we're in now. And maybe by reading it and understanding the Mahabharata, we can understand that the age we live in right now and not be so constantly surprised by it. So you can start with R.K. Narayan's version of it, which is very readable. Or you can just go to Mr. Google and ask him lots of questions. And one thing will lead to another, that will lead to another, that will eventually take you to the 60-year-old epic in India.
Can I ask, Joe, you mentioned, what age do we live in now? You said
the age of Kali, the Kali Yoga.
Are we post-heroic?
No, we're in this age. I think we're reading the apogee because, you know, the Kali Yoga is an age of nonsense, basically, when everything is turned on its head. And there's no reason, there's no logic, and there's no real light and dark, really. No real good and evil when everything gets confused.
And then what follows this age?
I don't know.
The end.
Apocalypse.
Oblivion. Oh, okay.
Because all the sort of the other stuff, the climax already happened in the Mahabharata. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They're also the great Amar Chitra Kave.
Yeah, they're wonderful.
Comic book series. Now they have an actual bumper issue
on the
Mahabharata.
Ah, I must
so
get that.
I really recommend
that. That's how I started off knowing about the Mahabharata, by reading these episodic comics.
Oh, wow.
Came from India.
Mm. Okay.
Very popular.
All right. So let's go find out about the Mahabharata from
comics.
From comics and from Mr. Google. And Edin, what's your recommendation?
Yes, well, I'd recommend, I got two things.
Okay. Oh, as usual.
Yeah. I've got a poem by Derek Walcott called Love After Love. You can look it up, you can Google it. It comes as a very short poem, and it's just a masterstroke in poetic diction, I think. So you can read that. The second one is, of course, my father's autobiography, which will be published on April the 12th.
Oh.
You will like it very much because it's full of this empirical evidence stuff and how, you know, writing an autobiography goes so much against the cultivated instincts of a trained historian. It's how it starts.
Oh.
So I think you'd like that very much.
Okay, I think. I'm not quite sure. I'm going to think about that one. But anyway, so thank you. And it only reminds me now to, well, first of all, please get in touch with us on all the different formats. Edin is your old fashioned, isn't it? Write you a letter? I can't remember.
Yes.
Write him a letter.
But I'm on Facebook.
Oh, he's on Facebook. Joe is, you're techno downsizing, aren't you?
I have no phone at the moment, so I'm very techno downsizing.
Right.
But you can ordinarily find me on Instagram. Send me a picture of your cat.
All right. Yes, Joe is becoming an Instagram person because she's young like that.
Yes.
Or our Facebook page. Please like it. Nothing happens there, but it's an epic experience in its own way. It is the Mahabharata of Facebook pages.
The poor English language.
So, only mention that thanks special on the guests, Joko Kuthas.
Thanks, Cam.
Edin Koo.
Lovely.
And myself, Cam Ruslan. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Summertime tips and fun facts from Paul, Kristen, and Dexter at Total Wine & More.
If you're topping off your burger with grilled onions and blue cheese, pair your work of art with a spicy Malbec.
Nothing beats a buttery Chardonnay with grilled corn on the cob. I'm ready to find you the perfect bottle of white for your next get-together.
Pack up the cooler for this weekend. We've got canned wine and beer ready to throw on ice.
Now with 9 locations in the Bay Area. Visit our newest store at Stevens Creek Central. Shop online at TotalWine.com. The selection is ridiculous. Cheers!